is an experiment, and if it doesn't work out, Andrea, you'll never get a handout again.
I was waiting for you to get a copy of the sermon before you preach it on Sunday morning.
That still isn't going to happen. Okay, so the first page there is not up for discussion. I just put it on there merely to show you how many of you got the view of heaven throughout your new church schooling, that there are two kingdoms, the celestial and the spiritual, 3 degrees of the heavens, so you divide it 1, 2, 3, celestial, spiritual, natural, and you end up with how many pieces of heaven?
Six.
Six. This is a possible way to solve that dilemma at the top, where you have a celestial heaven and kingdom, you have a spiritual heaven and kingdom, and then there is the spiritual natural, or the external of the spiritual kingdom, and the celestial natural, which is the external of the celestial kingdom. That actually lines up with passages that give you the 4 quarters of heaven, north, south, east, west. You have your 3 degrees of height. You have your 2 kingdoms. So you don't have to believe it, but it is a possible way to solve that puzzle of the height and the kingdoms. That front page is merely to show you that, yes, there are the 3 heavens there. Conversely, there are the 3 hells, and we have names for the 2 lowest hells. They're given to us as the satanic hell, as the middle hell, and they call them Satans that live there. And there is the lowest hell, the diabolical hell, and they say devils live there. So you have Satans and devils for terminology. And love of self and dominion rules in the lowest hell. Love of the world and riches rules in the middle hell. And the highest hell, we don't have a fancy name for, so maybe you can give some thought to what the highest hell might be called. But generally, the descriptions of that highest hell are they're rule breakers. They're disobedient. Disobedient. So I just labeled it there as the disobedient hell, but know that nowhere can I find there a name given to the highest hell. Just
Prescott Rogers said that Child's Hall at the Bernathan College, the boys' dorm, was probably where that was.
Yes. He is probably correct. So you can flip now. We're I know it was when I was there. That was probably part of the problem. So we have 8 questions we're going to look at, which gives us roughly 7.5 minutes a question. Now at the top, how many people are familiar with Pascal's wager? Okay, well, this is an extraordinarily simplified version of it, but the bottom line is it's smarter to believe in God in an afterlife than not. Statistically, it is smarter. Because if you choose to believe in God and a heaven and a hell, and choose, therefore, to follow his ways and what he commands, if you're right, top box, you have eternal joy. So there is a benefit to that system. If you're wrong and you're nothing but mulch and compost after you die, nothing. You haven't really lost anything. You won't even know that you're wrong. So there's at least an upside to that belief system. If, however, you choose to deny God and a life after death, and you're right, nothing, right? There's no life after death, no God, you're mulch, you're compost. You won't even know that you're right. So there's no upside there. But if you're wrong and there is an afterlife and a God who you've chosen to reject and disobey all his commandments, there's eternal suffering. So there's a big downside to non-belief. And so out of that comes one of my favorite bumper stickers. If you're living your life like there is no God, you'd better be right. And the bumper sticker I saw had little flames licking up over there. But there's something to that that I think is there. Now, I grew up with this on our fridge, and it was not a religious quote. Why worry? There are only two things to worry about. Either you are healthy or you are sick. If you are healthy, then there is nothing to worry about. But if you are sick, there are only two things to worry about. Either you will get well or you will die. If you get well, then there is nothing to worry about. But if you die, there are only two things to worry about. Either you will go to heaven or hell. If you go to heaven, then there is nothing to worry about. And if you go to hell, you'll be so darn busy shaking hands with your friends, you won't have time to worry. I was brought up in a religious household. I wonder why that was on the fridge. Yeah. So, humorous introduction, but there's nothing funny about hell. Do we really need to talk about hell? Short answer? Yes, the Lord talks about hell, so we obviously need to talk about hell. Now, I will point out that if you take the book Conjugal Love, most of it is about the delights of marriage, and then you have a portion about the insanities of adultery. Heaven and Hell, big long section about heaven, but we do also have a section about hell. So the Lord says we need to know about these things. Note these two passages at the beginning. Man is to live to eternity in either heaven or hell. Therefore, it's of highest importance to know how man acquires heavenly love. Startling statement, nothing is more necessary to man than to know whether heaven be in him or hell. For in one or the other, he must live to eternity. So the bottom line is here, you need to know about heaven. You need to know about hell so that you can make what kind of decision? Informed decision about where you think you would like to spend eternity. And it points out in AC 5135, and I think this is really important. How many of you, well, I guess probably most of you, since I see many parents out there, have had the opportunity to teach little children? When you teach religion, worship, things to little children, the idea of heaven and hell, as it says in that passage, they eagerly receive it. Because they need this sense that life, that people who do good go where? To heaven. And that people who do bad and hurt other people go where? Hell. There's a sense of justice that choices matter. And so early on, kids, they need this idea, initially a very simple distinction that there is a white, there is a black, there is a good, there is an evil, there is truth, there is falsity. They need this thing so that they understand that there are always basically two choices to make, and one is generally going to be good and the other is not. And so it matters for kids to have this idea that there's a heaven and a hell. And I'll point out something that's interesting. A minister pointed out to me. I'll leave him nameless. But it is a funny thing, and I used to do it. I probably still do it to some extent, but I've tried to be more balanced since. That in our memorial services that we give for people, and we choose our quotes from Scripture and from the heavenly doctrines, most ministers edit those quotes with the dot, dot, dots. You know, they give the first part of the quote and then the part that speaks about hell. Dot, dot, dot. The minister cuts that out. And the point that he was making is that, you know, often it's at memorial services when you get a whole bunch of people that don't necessarily come to church every Sunday. So what message do they get when they show up for their memorial service a year? Everybody goes to heaven, right? There's no downside. They come and they get this glowing thing, and no matter what anybody's done, everybody always ends up in heaven because they only get the first part of the passage. And usually in the Psalms, they're coupled very nicely. There's the this reward, and then there's the this punishment, and we always cut those out. And so it's just something to think about that just because you're reading both parts of the passage doesn't mean you're saying the person you're talking about is going to hell. But it's acknowledging that the way the Lord writes it, it's usually coupled. There's the positive and there's the downside. And so I've tried to at least make sure since then that people are aware there is a hell, at least, even though we're optimistic and hopeful that the person's going to heaven. Okay. Well, the sad thing is I have this lady who moved away from the congregation, and she strongly instructed her sons that she wanted me to do her memorial because she thought I was the only person who could make her look good. And so, next page. How does a person end up in hell? The bottom line is that they put themselves there. And this is a simple distinction the new church makes, but the images you have from Scripture are generally God sitting on the throne. There's some great pieces of Christian art that I've seen where he's sitting on the throne and the people are lined up, the books of life are open, and there's this, you know, sort of golden staircase going up to the right, and then the, you know, some hangdog guy standing there, and, you know, God's pointing to the left and down, and there's this dark. That's a grim image. That you're going to stand in judgment, and God is going to throw you into a sea of fire and brimstone. That's not how it really works. We will follow our own evils and we will cast ourselves down into hell. That's how we get there. It is a universal law in the middle of the page there, AC 1857, that evil punishes itself. That is to say that those who are in evil run into the punishment of their evil, but only when it's reached its height. The wicked thrust themselves down into hell, not in a moment, but successively. This has its origin in the universal law of order established by the Lord, that the Lord never casts anyone down into hell, but that the evil casts itself down, or that the evil person casts himself down. So the system is designed and built in that evil carries its own particular punishment with it. And if you are choosing to live that evil and to be that evil will bring that punishment upon you. And we know this to be true. Hopefully, in our lives where we have had times where we have made selfish choices, wrong choices, bad choices, and they come back upon us, and we're miserable and unhappy and sad, that's because those inherently, those types of choices have misery attached to them, and we bring them upon ourselves by choosing it. It is not that God is up there smiting you for your wickedness, which is how I know I often feel. But that's not how it works. Every evil carries its own punishment. The next number down there says that those who are not willing to be reformed or regenerated by the Lord cannot be saved. So you end up in hell when you are no longer willing to be reformed or regenerated. And I think that's a really encouraging point. In dealing with people when they're really distraught about evils they've gotten themselves into, as long as you are willing to still fight, the Lord can work with you. as long as you're willing to still fight and acknowledge that what you've done is wrong and evil, you're giving the Lord something to work with. It's when you reach the point where you are no longer willing to be reformed or regenerated. You don't want that. You have made your bed and you are content to lie and stay in that bed. That's when the Lord can no longer work with you. Because he is always willing. It's when your willingness gives up. Okay. The last number on page 3 there is just saying, re-emphasizing that the evil, as they cast themselves down into hell, it is a successive process and it's an orderly process. It's not like you come out of that state in the world of spirits, you wake up and, rah, you know, they throw you into the sea of fire and brimstone. You will wake up, will come to discover what your own delights and loves are fully, and you're going to follow the path of those delights. Okay. And so how do we end up in hell? One of the questions many people wrestle with, and at first it sounds like a good question, but it really doesn't end up being a very good one. If the Lord is all-powerful, if the Lord is all-wise, if the Lord is all-merciful, why can't he save everybody? Kids like to ask that one. And it sounds pretty good on the surface. The key is human freedom. The way love is. Love is free. And the Lord's love is free, and the Lord wanted us to experience the joy of that love, which means we had to be free. And if we are genuinely free, we have to be able to choose the opposite of good. We have to be able to choose evil. That's a nice way to look at it. But I think some people do. So it really does come down to this thing of freedom. We end up in hell because the Lord gave us true freedom. And if he were to try and move us against our will, we would, in the end, end up hating them. Every parent that's ever had a teen knows this to be true. Their hair triggers go up as they come into their own adult mind when they start to feel forced. They want to be their own person, and there's that tenuous period where we know their rational minds have not been opened yet, but they don't know that, and so they think they're rational, and they want to be free to choose as they see fit, and we're still making choices. But when they leave the house, the parents no longer can run their lives, because we buck and we rebel if we're trying to be forced. And so the Lord knows that he cannot force somebody to choose heaven who does not want it. See, does the Lord try to scare the hell out of us? What do you think?
Sort of.
I had a parishioner to remain nameless many years ago, was concerned that we read stories in the Word about war and evil and battles. And Couldn't we not read those things with the kids there? It'd be a very short book. And the question is, well, yeah, on the surface, why? When you pick up the word and there's murder and cheating and deceit and backstabbing and lying and wars, why is it there? Because hell is a real thing. And the Lord is telling us about this eternal struggle between what is good and what is evil. And so the language in there, I remember as a kid, there were some phrases, the Lord will come as a thief in the night, at an hour that you do not expect. And, you know, if I'd just stolen some cookies or done things that I was wont to do, I can remember lying there in bed thinking, "Woo, is this the night?" But those phrases are in there because what this next set of passages shows is that our external natural man is not altruistic. And so a starting point is to be afraid of hell. And I've said this before, but I believe it. If a young husband has entered the first state of cold in his early marriage and there's some, you know, young hot thing at work and he's entertaining the idea, if a passage about hell and death and fire and brimstone and being vomited out of the mouth rings in his head and stops him from doing that because he doesn't want to go to hell, that's a starting point. That's not going to get him into heaven. But if it controls that external natural man to the point to say eternity is a long time and hell's a bad place and the combination of those two is not something that I want, it's a starting point.
So at what point is it an appropriate state, though, and age? Because I have the same concerns that you mentioned with the pastor, just with the young, innocent children hearing a lot of violence in the Bible. And I've just questioned, does it match their state, and is it necessary? You know, I'm all about, like, I just want to do the peace and the love, and, you know, like, just have it be the innocent state and match that and not get too into that, because it is scary for kids. And so I'm wrestling with that a lot, so I wonder if you have any input about at what state, or, you know, does it actually match to...
Well, I believe there is that. My experience with that AC 5135 passage about children eagerly receiving the idea of a heaven and a hell and these conflicts, I've honestly never... What I find is the word is written in such a way that the stuff that kids aren't ready for tends to go right over their head. They don't even know... Like, they totally miss the stuff an adult might be like, whoa, that was brutal. It just tends to fly over. And when they're ready for it, they tend to ask the questions, you know, in class about it. That's been my experience. And even the mother who talked to me, it wasn't that she ever had her kids come to her and say, you know, that really scared me, that story. It was her concern that maybe they would be scared by the stories. But I've never actually had frightened children from a story from the Word. Have you?
Have I?
Yeah.
Well, I've had other moms talk to me about kids in the young classroom that have had nightmares and things like that. And so I've approached the, you know, going to the person in charge of the religious curriculum and just going over things and, you know, in a very open way.
Yeah.
Just maybe transfer.
Well, the,
and I've experienced that.
Yeah. With the older stories, absolutely, boys generally need to be curtailed in their delight of the...
So, and I have a very sensitive kid who's surrounded by, you know, who doesn't like that.
Yeah.
It's very hard for him.
I think that is often more a classroom management thing than a teachings from the word thing. Myself, just because I do believe God is omniscient and all wise, and I don't think he would have written a book that would damage children. So I think it would usually be in the presentation or how it's presented rather than the material. Matthew, do you have something to add to that?
Just a very simple point, but I wonder if part of the answer is that, of course, what that external state needs isn't just the fear of hell, but the possibility of the reward of heaven. And, you know, as kids, we obviously focus on that as well. And hopefully those are the remains that also get stirred and built up. That, oh, there's this beautiful place called heaven. I can go if I do follow the Lord. So just to point out, it's not just the fear of hell, but also that external want of the reward of heaven.
Yes.
That I think balances that out a little bit.
One of the first words that children learn at an extremely young age is no. Even in heaven, the very young children learn, the first words they learn is no. Because to say no to evil is an extremely important thing to learn to do. And if we're teaching about hell and teaching about the battles in a way that says, look, you're empowered, you can be like David, you can fight the giant, and you can prevail, then we're empowering them at a young age in a positive way, but we have to teach them about what they're fighting. The nightmare in their closet is there.
Yeah. All right, so I don't want to dwell because I'm not a scary person by nature. But there are, well, I had a sister who also tried to put the fear of hell in me on a regular occasion, calling me a Philistine, a heathen, and constantly telling me that there would be weeping and gnashing of teeth where I was going. So, is hell really eternal? How many of you have heard of Rob Bell? Rob Bell. Okay, I'm semi-sympathetic with him, and I don't want to get into a discussion of Rob Bell, but he's from the Protestant side of the equation, and was beginning to have serious questions about, you know, the whole theology of, you know, you're either baptized and in, you get to go to heaven, and not baptized in the right faith, you go to hell. And he was obviously seeing, that doesn't sound fair. So he wrote a book, Love Always Wins. And he puts out the possibility there of this sort of universalist idea that, you know, eventually over time, everybody gets out of hell and ends up in heaven.
Because of love.
Yeah, the Lord loves everybody. He's all powerful. And yes, there is a hell, but eventually, everybody will end up in heaven.
Heaven.
Nope. No. I don't think so. You don't think so. Well, can you see how there is a certain appeal to that idea? Now, he was, yeah. Julie?
So the cleaning bathrooms in heaven, that sounds like hell.
So, Dave.
My understanding is no one, if you have even a scintilla of goodness in you, you're not going to hell. So there's nothing for the Lord to work with for the people in hell. There's no scintilla of good in them. So
we will come back to that. That's a good point. Yeah, but you're right, in the new church, this idea is creeping in.
So there's the passage that goes with that, which I'm very drawn to, but I will then lift it up and draw all men to me from what the Lord said.
Yes.
And I think that's where it starts.
Yes. Yeah, well, it says in that passage that the Lord's will is that he would draw all men to himself. It says, and this, somebody, I think Pierce said earlier that, you know, a lot of new church people set their bar sort of at the natural heaven, if I can just get in. But this passage says the Lord would not want us on the threshold of heaven or the lowest heaven or even the middle or the highest, but it said if he could, he would draw us into himself. That's the nature of his love. And that is absolutely true, but the nature of his love also included in that is he can only do what we will allow him to do in freedom. And so while the Lord would want all people to be as close to him as possible, some people will not choose that, and he will allow that. I think you...
I think you should answer that. It would be contrary to the whole, you know, where you were before, where, you know, why does the Lord just force people to be good? Well, that extends to the eternity question of hell, so he would be contrary to that proposal.
Yes.
That's why he has the Lord of Spirits, right? So you make that choice there.
Yes.
It allows you to be influenced by both sides so that you can make that choice.
Correct. Now, one other idea, and we're going to keep moving. Another idea that's become popular is reincarnation of various sorts. And the idea in reincarnation is you do it, you learn, but if you didn't do it right, you come back again and you do it again, and you'll keep doing that until you get it right. They're popular ideas, and I think they come from a place of compassion, which is that the Lord wants everybody to be in heaven. We like the idea of everybody ending up good and being in heaven. But it's important to know why that is not necessarily merciful. So that's what we're going to talk about. But first, is hell really eternal according to what the Lord says in the heavenly doctrines? It notes right at the beginning there, they who make salvation to consist in faith alone and not at the same time of a life of faith. That's key, life. That is a life of charity. Believe that anyone can come into heaven and to the Lord no matter how he has lived. If they are asked if an evil man can be among the good, they say that by the mercy of God he can, because it is a work of omnipotence. New Jerusalem and its heavenly doctrine, 239, the life of man cannot be changed after death. It then remains such as it had been. All who come into hell remain there to eternity. Next number, those who come into hell remain there forever. Next number, therefore, those who are in the state of hell cannot be transferred into the state of heaven, for the evils in the former reject the goods in the latter. That is meant by the great gulf that was fixed. There are tons of passages in the writings. Most of them are included here. And I was actually surprised how often the writings talked about the eternity of the hells. Now, We'll get to the fairness question later. But the other big question is, why can't we change? Now, Dave spoke to this a little bit in the other life. So we've lived wickedly our whole life. We wake up in the other life, hell staring at us, and we say, I want to choose heaven now. Are you free to do so?
Does anyone want to? I mean, if they've lived a terrible life, are they like, darn, I wish I hadn't? I mean, they're probably pleased with the idea of going to hell.
Well, initially they are, and that's the funny thing. It says many Christians, and I would probably extrapolate that out to anybody who has been raised with any religious consciousness, when they wake up in the next world and they have lived a life of evil, they know that they're supposed to want heaven because that's the good place and hell's the bad place. So there's that, what you might say, that thought process of, I'm supposed to want heaven. And so they are allowed to try that out. You know, they say, I want heaven. And the Lord says, you can have heaven. That's your choice. And they quickly find out that the rules in heaven, the way things happen in heaven, actually seems very much like hell to them. And they eventually go. So, but there is a state with those who have had some instruction that says, yeah, I should want heaven. And then it's them discovering that actually what heaven is, they really don't want.
Is there anything with all these numbers that the writing cites to do that says anything about percentages of people who choose to live in hell for eternity? Is it as well populated as heaven or not?
There are, and not in here, but there are a few numbers in the writings during the time of the second coming, which was a last judgment time, that mentions seemingly many more people going towards hell than heaven. But remember, the time of the Lord's two comings came at a time when things were black. So we might expect that to be the case. What the percentages are now, I would have no idea.
So if they try that out with heaven and find that they do have a change is there a chance for a change of love, like toward love? Like, so you're saying they try it on, it doesn't, it ends up feeling more like hell and they end up choosing hell. But is there still that chance discovering that actually they do have that interior,
I would say, based on the passages, I would say no. Now, do they have the freedom to do so? Yes. The lowest devil today that has been there for 80,000 years still can choose heaven, in theory. In reality, he won't. He still can, but he won't. Now, let's...
Brad,
yes?
Can somebody have a near-death experience that would wake them up and they say, ooh, there it is. Oh, there it is. I see it now. That's what I want.
Depending...
I just read a book about that.
As long as the person is not being compelled by external signs beyond which he is willing to be compelled. Like the Lord is not going to do the type of miracle that blows you away so much that even though everything in your body says, I don't want to believe that, you're going to believe it now because he did that. He always is going to work in the context of freedom. And if there is something that can get you to start mulling things over, then yes.
What do you mean by the lowest, devil's free
Well, there's a bit of a semantic thing that he is free to, but he won't. And here's the reason why. See if these help at all. Maybe they'll just make you angrier. So why can't we change? One of the things that's fascinating, now notice the language in Divine Providence 279, it is an error of the age to believe that the state of man's life can be changed instantly, and thus from being an evil man can become good, and in consequence be led out of hell and transferred straightway into heaven, and this by the Lord's mercy apart from means. Goes on further in the passage, those who believe in instant salvation and mercy apart from means do not know that affections, which belong to the will, are nothing but changes of the state of the purely organic substances of the mind, and that thoughts, which belong to the understanding, are nothing but changes and variations in the form of these substances, and that memory is the state of these changes and variations that remains permanent. Now, a number of these passages go on to talk about, we think of thoughts as merely, well, have for thousands of years, as merely flitting things going in and out. I would say brain science is now catching up with what the writings have said, and that is that our changes in affections and the consequent thoughts therefrom have organic changes in the mind. And so a lot of the brain mapping they're doing now find when, you know, you use your certain rage centers, you are growing synapses and things are happening there, and on that micro scale, things are developing. And when you don't use those things, they recede and shrink in other areas. They're finding that the brain is a truly dynamic, evolving, changing thing. But how many of you have heard the expressions, the person's wired to think that way? Yeah, and we had this with our son Joram, who was deaf. The first 2 years of his life, his brain was wired to be totally visual with no audio because he was deaf. And then when he got the PACs put on, it was a rewiring that was trying to take place in the brain that is fairly successful at that point. But throughout the course of our life, we are literally forming our patterns of thought. We are forming the way that we think. And as long as we're on this planet, that vessel the Lord gave us is workable. And we can change significantly the way that we think, the way that we feel. But have you ever heard of a crusty old person? Yeah, there's none here today. And we probably also know, you know, the very sweet Gentile person, and the very sweet gentle person, you know, doesn't suddenly wake up the next morning and, you know, become a curmudgeon. That we form the way that we are successively in order, step by step. And so we are forming our character as to who we are, and it's not just totally abstract mental. It comes down into our very formation and the formation of our spirit. Okay, so I think part of it is when we think of our spirit that we're forming as a ghost or something ethereal flitting around, then you can instantly change that. But if you view your spirit as something you are successively forming step by step by the choices that you make, you can't undo all that in a moment. And so it actually talks about our patterns here. We form spirals, sort of, either a spiral going this way, heading up in our pattern of thought and regeneration, or reverse spiral heading down towards that. And we're forming our vessel in these patterns, and you can't just totally undo in a moment that pattern. Now, and so the real key, 411, that's repeated many times is, as was stated this top of page 7, and because the interiors of the mind of those who are in evils and falsities therefrom are turned away in a contrary direction, or to a quarter opposite to divine goods and truths. Therefore, when divine truth flows in and endeavors, which the Lord would do, endeavors to reverse the action of the interiors of their mind and thereby to lead them into heaven, for this is what divine truth proceeding from the Lord does everywhere where it flows in, they are unwilling to abandon the delights of their loves. So they suffer anguish and torment, but these cease when they come into the hells where the like delights or like loves prevail.
Kind of like you're building a slinky and you're putting that curve into it again and again as you go through your life. And the Lord might want to unwind the slinky and make it go the other direction, but we're very resistant to that. We stay with the direction that we want to be turned in.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And that it is a process. Everything.
I just want to say that it seems to me that if you believe what you're saying, that these things happen gradually instead of suddenly. We all like to think about, just change, going to heaven. But if it's everything is very gradual, which makes sense from our experience, then there you'd be hard pressed to find something in hell. That would gradually lead someone towards heaven. Yeah. So it doesn't, so even though, because I'm hearing you say that it actually would be possible according to the laws of heaven for someone to stand up and decide, I don't want to be in hell, I want to go to heaven. In other words, the laws of heaven are not preventing them. What's preventing them is themselves.
Correct.
Because gradually they're not moving that direction to the point where they would climb out of hell.
And they find it torturous, and yeah, they're welcome, but they find it torturous.
And we also learned about all the vast nations that clear out anything that would make you want to change.
Yes. So the CL 524, and we're down to a scant 15 minutes, says, moreover, that if it were changed, meaning the whole order of a person's life that they had chosen, the organic structure would be destroyed, which can never happen. They also said that a change in the organic structure is possible only in the material body and not at all possible in the spiritual body after the former has been cast off. They further added that a change of organization can only take place in the material body and by no means in the spiritual body after the former is rejected. So, part of what I want to highlight is how this is merciful. Because we want things to be fair. This, by the way, is what gives life meaning. I know for myself, if there was always a chance to be better later, I would generally choose that option. But this is what makes this life, while so short in the scheme of eternity, so meaningful and so rich and so beautiful and so powerful and so tragic all at the same time, is because our choices matter. They really, really matter in the eternal scheme of things, and that's wonderful. So how does all this demonstrate the Lord's mercy? Well, one, he doesn't want to destroy who we've chosen to be, which we just talked about. But the other is that it is truly a process. That before the evil are condemned and let down into hell, they undergo so many states that it is altogether unknown in the world. It is believed that man is at once either condemned or saved, and that this is effected without any process. But the case is otherwise. Justice reigns there, and no one is condemned until he himself knows and is inwardly convinced that he is an evil and that it is utterly impossible for him to be in heaven. His own evils are also laid open, and he's warned to desist from those evils. So they go through this whole process. There are countless memorable relations of devils trying hell, heaven. You know, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try. And they find that heaven is hell to them. And so eventually they realize that what they want to do is follow the loves they have chosen. And that this idea of heaven being a good place was something that they had been taught, but it's not what they love.
So what about the person who is 20 or 30 years old, has chosen an evil life, but then sees the light and discovers the Lord and changes his life and changes his love and everything on earth, okay? What about that same person dies at 20. So they haven't yet shifted or changed on this earth. I don't understand what the material body has to do with being able to, having that chance to make that change or not. Like, if that same person was taken at 20, but if they had lived 40, 50 more years.
Well, we're not going to go there today. We can talk after. We really are running out of time. But there's that leads to the whole question of why do we have to be born on earth at all? Why didn't the Lord just create us all spiritual beings with no natural and do away with this whole world thing? So that's a big question, and we have about 13 minutes and much more to cover. So, but there is a reason we are here and why it does matter. Otherwise, the Lord wouldn't ever have created a natural.
Yeah, I trust that. It's just, I'd love to talk
more. Okay. Part of the mercy is twofold. Flipping to page 8. Here's one of those things where, they're listening to the angels and the devils are declaring that they've been mad for the way they've been choosing. But as this was not their own proper state, and as after a few minutes it became tiresome and unpleasant, they turned away from the priest and were unwilling to listen to him any longer. Sounds like my congregation. So they returned to their former loves, which were merely natural, worldly, and corporeal. And as their delight was a delight in doing evil, and as they did evil to many on the way, they were imprisoned and became demons. So they get the fairness thing, I would just say, apart from the whole organic structure thing, is everybody is given the opportunity for heaven. They choose it. Sometimes they try it out multiple times. And as that other passage said, it's not until they themselves are inwardly convinced that that is not where they want to be that they choose to follow their loves down into hell. So The Lord doesn't let anybody end up in hell out of ignorance or against their will. The people who are there are those who chose it because they wanted it, even though they were afforded every other opportunity. The other reason it's merciful, it says everyone goes the way of their love after death, nor does it find any rest except in the society where his reigning love is. So the Lord is allowing you to follow the things that you love. What could be more merciful than that? Giving you genuine freedom, giving you rationality, giving you instruction, and then allowing you to follow your loves. Another reason, it is according to order that all who have lived well shall be saved, and that they who have lived ill shall be condemned. Hence it is impossible that they who have lived well should be sent into hell, and that they who have lived ill should be raised into heaven. This passage, it's a long one. I cut parts out here, but part of the reason this shows the Lord's mercy is it is a just and fair system. It's not an arbitrary system where God is up there saying, well, you got the right water on your head, so you're in, and you didn't, so you're out. Or, yeah, you lived wickedly, you loved doing evil, but I want you in heaven, so I'm pulling you up there with me, no, even if you don't want it. And, well, this good person seems a little too smiley by the choices he's made, so I'm throwing him down into hell. It's not an arbitrary system. It is a just, fair system based on our choices. And you can't get much more fair than that. The other reason hell is there is not just because the Lord respects their freedom of choice and allows them to follow their loves, but the nature of evil is to do harm to good. And so the Lord has to have that great gulf fixed between heaven and hell so that those who have chosen a life of evil cannot inflict their misery and their pain on those who have chosen a life of good. And that is their constant desire. There's a passage that I don't have in here that is truly frightening that says, the nature of every evil, if followed to its extent, would be to kill the divine. So every evil has in it a hatred of the Lord as its root core. So not to be messed with, and the Lord knows this. And so if people choose to follow those things, he has to keep the angels safe and away from them. Okay, top of page 9, 7 scarce minutes here. It says, angels are continually led upwards towards the Lord, but because a devil man or a man choosing evil is continually also led away from evil by the Lord, but to a more or less grievous evil. The Lord always only works as far as we're willing to bend. And a devil may not let him lead him out of hell, but the Lord is constantly trying to withhold him from worse and worse evils. And it says that a devil man is in freedom and in the delight of his heart. Now notice this, when he is doing good from evil. So even when he's doing good, if it's from evil for selfish motives, he's still delighted by it because it leads to reputation, honor, gain, or when he is doing evil. But the bottom line is he's in the delight of his heart when he is doing things from evil. It's merciful because we always have a longing to return to our ruling loves. To change that love in the Spirit is to take away or extinguish his life. take away or extinguish his life. The Lord's not going to do that to you. Flipping over. More of the same. Okay. DP 338, subsection 6. After death, no one is denied entrance into heaven. The way is pointed out to him, opportunity is afforded him, and he is even introduced. But as soon as he enters and inhales with its breath its delight, he begins to feel pain in his breast, to suffer torture in his heart. And he falls into a swoon in which he writhes like a serpent being brought close to a fire. Then with his face turned away from heaven and turned towards hell, he flees headlong down and does not rest till he is in the society of his own love. Freedom and delight go hand in hand, and if diverted from that delight, he would be enraged. So this leads to another, what I think is a bit of a new church heresy. I find it amongst kids. There's this idea of, well, the new church idea of hell is so merciful that in essence it doesn't really matter which you choose. And it goes along this line of, well, we're all getting to follow our ruling loves. We're all having the freedom to engage in them. So what's the difference? Either way, you get to follow your ruling love and you're as happy as you can be. And then the jump happens that, well, maybe a devil's just as happy as in hell as an angel is in heaven. And that is not true. I think all the teachings we have about hell that are so sad and so miserable is the Lord trying to tell us your choices really do matter and heaven and hell are not the same. There is a great gulf fixed between those two choices, and that yes, a devil is happier in hell than he would be in heaven, but that does not mean that hell is a happy place compared to heaven. It's as happy as that devil can be based on the choices and loves he has chosen to pursue. So here's one of those numbers. Are devils truly happy? Swedenborg had a conversation with them. When he came near them with the light of the truth, it hurt them. Swedenborg couldn't understand why they wouldn't want, you know, I'm telling you about heaven, this whole other life that's so much better, and it tormented them and hurt them. And they stated that they would 1,000 times rather live in hell than out of it. They're like, if that's heaven, we would much rather be here. But it's not happy, and here's why. The devils replied, top of page 11, know then that everyone, whether he be called, notice they say be called, good or evil, enjoys his own delight. He that is called good is in the enjoyment of his delight, and he that is called evil is in the enjoyment of his. Then the angels asked, what is your delight? They said it was a delight in whoredom, revenge, fraud, and blasphemy. They were further asked, what do these delights appear like to you? They said they were perceived by others as fetid odors from dunghills, putrid carcasses, and stagnant urine. And are these, asked the angels, delightful to you? They replied, yes, most delightful. Then said the angels, you are like the unclean beasts that wallow in such things. They answered, be it so, but such things are a delight to our nostrils. On being asked to say more on this matter, they replied, everyone is allowed the enjoyment of his delight, even though it be called the most unclean, provided he does not infest good spirits and angels. But because our delight is such that we cannot refrain from molesting them, we are put in workhouses where our sufferings are great. The restraint upon our delights in these places and the denial of their satisfaction are what are called the torments of hell. There is present also an interior pain. The angels ask further, "Why do you infest the good?" "We cannot do otherwise," they replied. That's not a happy picture. But that's the hell. In heaven, yes, you get to follow the loves you have chosen, the good loves you have chosen of loving the Lord, loving your neighbor, and you will never have the Lord jumping in and stop you and say, "You are loving too much, cool down." You can fully express the desires of your heart, those good loves you have chosen. In hell, you can follow your evil loves that you have chosen, which involve being selfish, harming other people, putting yourself above others. You can do that, but ultimately, because you desire to be over other people and put them down and put yourself up, you're going to cross the boundaries and you're going to be reined back in. And so it's the hell is not fully being able to realize your selfish loves.
Well, everybody that wants to dominate and push everyone else down and raise themselves up, they're all in a group together. So everyone in that group is trying to push everyone else down and pull themselves up.
Yes.
So there's constantly a battle of wills and fighting to make everybody your slave, and they're going to make you their slave. Or else they're trying to grab all the toys, and so are you.
Yeah. And I am being told I have to wrap this up because we have the people mover. Let me read one last quote here. "Children of Israel often thought the Lord's ways were not fair. And the Lord says, 'Do I have any delight at all in the death of the wicked, and not in him returning from his ways that he should live? But you say, the way of the Lord is not fair. Hear now, O house of Israel, is it not my way which is fair, and your ways which are not fair?'" The bottom line is the Lord's ways are fair, and he has given you genuine freedom and rationality to make choices and freely choose to love and follow him, and that is the desire of his heart. And as we said, everything he does is to get you into heaven, but he loves you so much that if you choose to reject him and disobey his commandments and follow the dictates of your own heart, he will honor that choice and respect it to all eternity. And that is a very merciful God. Thank you.